Session number 7304, reel 2.
Colonel King, reel 2. You were saying that some of the Egyptian police were armed.
Yes, they had some of the ones on guard duty at gates and vulnerable points. They had these policemen there with sort of single-barrel shotguns, lethal-looking weapons. The police officers, again, some of them carried sidearms, a pistol in a holster. And I don't recall the ordinary policemen in the street being armed, the ones on traffic duty and patrols and things like that being armed, the walking patrols in the streets. I don't think they were.
How long were you employed in this internal security role?
Until I think... I say only think, because I had left the battalion by this time. I think until about June 1940. Because I had left the battalion earlier to go on a staff appointment.
What was this staff appointment?
This was a GSO3 headquarters British troops in Egypt. But I wasn't in, which was in Cairo, but I wasn't in Cairo. I and another captain and a major, under the direction of more senior people, a brigadier in headquarters of British troops in Egypt, were specially formed into a team in order to lay out defences from the sea west of Alexandria down the line of the delta to Cairo. The reason was because Graziani had progressed from Libya and to Sidi Barani, and there was absolutely nothing except, I think, two battalions and an armoured car regiment between him and Alexandria. And naturally, the Navy were extremely worried. Most of the Mediterranean fleet were based on the Alexandria. There was some in Gibraltar, naturally, but most of it was on the western side, on the eastern side in Alexandria. And they said, right, if Alexandria falls, what happens to the British fleet? Similarly, the fleet air arm had a very large airfield west of Alexandria. Loss of that airfield means loss the striking power that the fleet air arm had, and which, may I say, they operated with tremendous efficiency at Taranto, on the Taranto raid, which was done from Dhekelia onto aircraft carriers onto the raid, back onto the aircraft carriers, flown back onto the airfield. And they were naturally extremely worried if they lost that airfield. So, they made their point, and this team of ours had to lay out defences from, as I say, the sea to down along the line of the delta of the Cairo.
How many of you were there in the team?
I'll deal with my end, namely the Alexandria end, where I was. I had a major there, an infantry major. There was myself as his number two, and there was one, two, three sapper officers of varying ranks. I think the most senior was a major, going down to a captain and a subaltern. The actual layout was the responsibility of this major and myself. And we had to do a detailed layout right down to section posts and the line of the anti-tank trench. There were all sorts of problems because to dig an anti-tank trench into the sea poses quite a few problems. Because, I mean, although I'm told it isn't tidal, you still get winds and things that blow in sand, and so it had to be designed from the sea end. It also then had to be designed because the coast there, you've got the sea looking westwards, you've got the sea on your right, you've then got a area of about a mile of white, white sand and sand dunes, and two sand dunes. That's right. And then you get sandstone. Then you get the road, the Western Desert Road, which goes right out to Alamein and Merzimetru. You get that. And then on the south side of that road, there's a small escarpment and a drop down to a lake called Lake Mariotte, Mariotte. So your anti-tank ditch went from the sea, went through the sand dune country, so it all had to be vetted. Then you had to have a system over the road, and a bridge over the road, over your anti-tank ditch which crossed the road, cut through the escarpment, the high bit of ground that went up, dropped down, and a similar wet ditch, so to speak, into the lake. Now, you had to have engineers for that, naturally. And, of course, it couldn't be done by... There weren't sufficient sappers to initially. So it was all done by contract.
By local labour, then?
By local labour. A contractor was or several contractors were employed.
How deep was this anti-tank ditch?
It was a pretty enormous thing. I mean, it was sufficient to take... I suppose the... it must have been six in depth at its greatest point was between 6 and 8 foot in the dry part. Then you had the slope back on the enemy side. Now what had been done was all the soil that had been dug in the dry part was dozed away, so you could not see that there was going to be a ditch. It was flattened, except from the air, of course. But you couldn't know. On the seaside, you had this wet ditch, which joined up with the dry ditch by some extraordinary means which I honestly can't explain. And that went right out into the sea, and that was a canal. And that was considerably wider than the dry part. It was virtually a canal. It was dug out. The same on the lakeside. The same on the lakeside.
So the ditch actually went in under the water?
Yep. Into the water. Well, later on, there was all sorts of small defences out into along the line of the beach, barbed wire and stakes and goodness knows what, to prevent anything that could come along the beach, just quite close to the sea. That's right. That's right. Then behind all this ditch, of course, well, actually, forward of the ditch, there were patrol positions, standing patrol positions sighted. Behind the ditch, there you had a complete brigade position laid out.
How far ahead of the anti-tank ditch were these patrol bases?
Oh, quite a long way. I think there was something in the region of... they varied, but I should think anything between half a mile and a mile ahead.
And what were they? Were they platoon?
No. No, they were just small outpost positions of about a section strong.
So would they be a basis for forward security.
That's right. They were. That's right. They would be, any patrols would, if there was enemy approaching, that went out would go through those outpost positions, through forward of that. And they were really then listening posts under normal conditions there. Listening posts and out, and perhaps they were, if enemy did attack, they were the first thing the enemy would counter as outposts.
Presumably the idea would be that if they saw anything important coming their way, they would report on it and then withdraw.
Indeed, that's the idea.
Was it intended they would be purely infantry?
No. Because you had a lot of many pillboxes made for anti-tank weapons, covering your ditch. You had the, behind that, again, you had artillery, field gun positions there, guns actually, in concrete gun positions.
Not dug in,
because you had lots of positions there, so you could move your guns to where you wished. So, I mean, for a troop of four guns, you probably had anything up to about 12 positions, which those troops could be moved into as they wished.
Were there concealed
routes
for transferring?
Yes, there was. Not for the infantry, no. But the guns was, yeah, because one tried to choose the positions so that there was a little bump. I don't think you ever would have concealed them because, quite frankly, the dust and the stuff of movement would have given away. But, of course, what you could do by night, you could move your guns from one position to another without any problem at all, because you wouldn't see them move.
So you had artillery spotters?
Yes. Oh, yes, you had OPs there. They were concrete things. The whole basis was pillbox type. All the infantry defences were pillbox.
Did the anti-tank ditch run in a straight line?
No.
Or was it in a zigzag?
No, in a zigzag. The zigzag was caused by the country, of course. Not because one wanted to zigzag it in order to be able to fire down it that way, but it was caused actually by the country. It was a natural thing. But, of course, a lot was. Especially on the seaside there, one had it zigzag on purpose so that one'd be able to get to shoot down the various corners, you know, of the ditch.
What sort of pillbox did you build for the anti-tank guns then?
Very similar to the ones you saw in England.
So hexagonal, were they?
Yes, but they were much better, if I may say so, prepared, because both the infantry ones for the infantry posts and for the anti-tank posts there were very, very close to the ground. I mean, the slit was very, very close to the ground, so the pillbox didn't stand up.
So you'd have a grazing fire.
Indeed. And the whole thing was sloped off, the top, so you didn't have you couldn't spot them very easily. And the front was camouflaged, and in the end it was very difficult to see either the anti-tank positions there or the infantry positions from the enemy side when it was completed.
Were these also constructed primarily by local civilian
Yes,
contractors?
Yes. And were finished off latterly by we had a squadron of New Zealand engineers who were going to move up in the desert, and they were, what you might call, training and resting there before they moved up in the desert, training and acclimatization and all the rest of it, and they came in. They were terrific. They were marvellous people.
The anti-tank pillboxes, how many guns could you actually put into each pillbox?
One, I think.
And that presumably be a 2-pound?
It was. There were some 6-pounders coming along then, actually, because the infantry had 2-pounders, but I think, as far as I recall, we had to make a proportion of them, if not all, to take a 6-pounder, which was the artillery piece. The anti-tank regiment of Royal Artillery, I think.
Have you an idea how far the distance was normally between one anti-tank pill box and the next?
Entirely dependent on the country. Down by the coast, where you could get a first-class chute, down there, one could have it up to, I suppose, 300 yards or 400 yards between them, where, because you could then get a nice enfiladed shot. But as you got up towards the road and then up that the slope towards, then drop down to Scotland, the lake there, it was much more difficult, and so you couldn't get the same sort of shoot. And so I imagine, I remember, they were much closer together.
So it was line of sight that determined.
Indeed, and line of sight, that's right. And of course your final thing was the maximum range.
What was that reckoned to be then?
Well, at the tanks we reckoned would operate against us at the time there. For the two-pounder, it was about 250 yards.
These were the Italian medium.
That's right. But for the six-pounder, of course, was something in the region of, I think, about 600 yards, as far as I remember.
The forward bases ahead of the anti-tank ditch, they weren't pillboxes, were they?
No. They were little trenches dug and revetted, but with no spoil. With no spoil showing, so they would not show from the enemy side. No spoil. And they were revetted, and some of them were actually concrete coffins, almost. Rather deep coffin, but that sort of idea.
Were they a sort of redoubt for a section, or were they, did it consist of two-man rifle pits?
They were that. That's more. That's much more like it for the outposts in front of the ditch. Behind, you had a complete. Those section positions were completely self-contained. They had the post where the sentries were, the post the place where the LMG would be, and behind you had living quarters. Living quarters. Off the living quarters there, which were, you had ammunition, a little more place for ammunition, another little place for storage of rations.
Were the individual small positions linked by communication trenches?
Yes. Entirely and absolutely. Entirely and absolutely. It was a miniature Maginot line, but simpler than the Maginot line, of course. God knows what it cost. It must have cost an absolute bomb.
Could you tell me now about the main position behind the anti-tank ditch? How far behind the anti-tank ditch were the main lines?
You mean the main infantry, sort
yes.
of thing? Again, as I say, it entirely depended on the country, just there. Because I say the country varied so much, and it depended on the country, the field of fire. Oh, I must say that at this stage, we cleared fields of fire there. We had these vast, enormous dozers and graders and things like that, and we cleared fields of fire. If there was a bump of a very large dune or similar thing in front, we just said, remove it. And so it was just graded away.
So you're building a glass sheet then?
So in the end, I mean, you could really, in a lot of places, you dictated what the country should be like, not the country dictating to you. That was fine on the seaside, up towards the road. But from the road to the south, going inland, down to the lake there, no, you couldn't do that, because you are on pretty tough sandstone sort of rock. Sandstone, not terribly tough, but even so, not the sort of thing you can want to grade away or doze away. That was jolly good for building point of view, because I mean, all you had to do there was dig a hole into the rock, and you had your walls and everything else there.
Put a concrete lid.
That's right, and you put a concrete lid on. And this is where brigade headquarters further back was. I mean, it was quite easy to build brigade headquarters. It was the sand area that was the difficult one.
You mentioned that these lines, the infantry lines, were basically pillboxes. How many men would you put into a pillbox?
You'd get up to the normal infantry section there, which was about, I suppose, maximum would be 10 men, more likely to be 8. And I think we, as far as I recall, we could fit in 10.
So each pillbox would basically have a light machine gun plus
a rifle. That's right.
In it.
That's right. And the communications ran right down to the platoon there.
Line communications,
and to the platoons, and there was a lot of lateral communication. So if a shell knocked out platoon to company headquarters, you could get platoon headquarters, and then back to company headquarters. And also there was communications out to the outpost positions.
Would I be right in saying then that you had clusters of 3 pillboxes? And the basic principle was that they should be within sight of the anti-tank dish so that they could cover it.
That's right. At least 2 of the sections of the 3 in a platoon would be able to fire over the anti-tank ditch. The other section would be able to cover the rear of both the other 2 sections. And then behind that, you'd have your platoon headquarters and probably the reserve section of the platoon. That's how, covering, again, the rear of the 2 front sections.
It's really rather like the 2 up formation.
That's what it would be. Well. Nearly in every case there, we had, on a platoon, you had 2 sections up, 1 in rear. Similarly, you had 2 platoons up and 1 in rear in the area of company headquarters. So you were getting defence in depth. And you got anti-tank defence in depth. I mean, you didn't have all your anti-tank along the ditch. You had anti-tank in depth because you thought ultimately, inevitably, if they got infantry across that ditch and they managed to bridge it, then you've got to have it in depth later for the tanks coming through.
So you had to cover the potential crossing points.
That's right.
Routes in.
Yeah. It was, on the whole, it was quite a wide front for a brigade, in fact.
Did you have alternative positions for infantry?
Yes.
You mentioned having those guns.
Yes, you did. As you went back, you had a sort of fallback position. But mind you, not as elaborate. Nowhere near. I mean, virtually then, there was no sleeping accommodation, nothing. There was just some trenches dug there and revetted.
Were the trenches again? I mean, how many men would a trench actually hold? Would it be a 2 or 3 man?
The whole section. So well, in actual fact, you're quite right. No, it was a two or three man. So you had possibly for a section 2 or 3 trenches.
Did you have wire to strengthen the position?
Yeah. Yes. You had wire, but you didn't have it. You didn't, the wire was not Dannet. As far as I recall, it was purely barbed wire. There might have been Dannet on the edge of the water, on the sea, but I can't recall it.
So it was in
conventional? A lot of the actual wiring wasn't done till afterwards. Until the position was occupied.
So the wire is being held in reserve.
That's right. There was a certain amount of wire where, in the stony part, in the sandstone part, where you had to put in your pickets and things like that because it was practically impossible to drive them in with a sledgehammer. And that was actually sort of fixed. But further down in the sandy part towards the sea and also down towards the lake, you didn't.
What about mines?
Never laid when I was there. The minefield was, put it this way, was plotted. It was on maps, but nothing else. It was never laid.
What about the artillery? How far behind the infantry?
No, now you're asking me. Uh, I can only give you a wild guess. Now, he was about 6 to 1,000 yards, or something like that, behind. I think.
And what sort of position did you have for them? Were they just deep pits, individual gun pits?
They were individual gun pits, yes. Some of them had cover. Because these were guns that were also sighted in the anti-tank rail. It was 25-pounder, you see, sighted in the anti-tank rail. And they had, far as I recall, they had cover. I don't know why, quite frankly, but they did. I think it probably was because they needed an apron, a blast apron or something in front when you're firing on low trajectory. But not being a gunner, I'm not awfully sure of that.
But you were planning for basically the standard field artillery.
That's right.
Was there any provision for medium
artillery? None. 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 They would have had to be, quite frankly, if we had medium, there'd have to be just ordinary gun pits dug by hand at the time, if you were allocated a medium regiment or medium battery.
How did you actually go about the business of laying these lines out? Did you do it initially off the map, or did you actually go down and look at the ground?
You're absolutely right about that. We first of all did it off the map, because you're rather dependent on the two things you were dependent on, the airfield, the naval airfield. So you had to get well enough forward of that. So that an enemy standing off the position couldn't shell that airfield, or if they could, they'd need something more than an ordinary field artillery piece.
In which case you could bring up your mediums in the counter.
That's right, indeed you could, you see. But that was the principle. That was the first thing. So you did a sort of sausage on the map and said this is where we'll have it. Then we went out on the ground. And may I say, this was then at a level which is, I mean, I just was what you might call an observer, because it wasn't for us, our little team, to decide where these should be. This was much more senior. I mean, we even had one stage there. Jumbo Wilson out there, who's the GOC CBTE, who came, you see, out there initially. And I mean, it wasn't him who said yes there, but I mean, it was one of his staff there, senior, and I think somewhere around the rank of Brigadier Major General, who said, yep, agreed.
So they. How far down did they go? I mean, did they just say, this is the main area, now you get on
that's
the
right.
out of the
that's right.
position?
Well, above, as I say, this team, there was a half-colonel down in Cairo who was part of the team.